Welcome. This is the podcast of Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
A very warm welcome to our Care in Action podcast, the podcast of Care Austria. Mrs. Dolika Banda is our guest today. A warm welcome.
Thank you very much, Andrea. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be here.
We are producing this podcast via Zoom, just for our regular listeners who think that the sound is a bit different than normally. Dolika, at the moment, you are where?
I'm in London, actually.
Ah, you're in London. So that's quite close to Vienna.
Yes.
And like always, I want to introduce our guest briefly before we start our conversation. Dolika Banda is an independent consultant with over 30 years of experience in global banking and development finance, focusing on equitable and inclusive economic transformation in sub-Saharan Africa. She has held senior positions at the International Finance Corporation, British International Investment and African Risk Capacity Insurance Ltd. Currently, Dolika serves on several boards, including as chair of Standard Chartered Bank Zambia and as a board member at Care USA, which is one of the main reasons why I'm happy to have her as our guest today. She is also a founding partner of Mondial Impact, a firm dedicated to shaping sustainable and impactful investment. And the second board member on this of Care US on our podcast series. And inside Care, we talk a lot about, or the world is talking a lot about, innovation. Everybody wants to be innovative. And as you are in London, and you know it anyhow, the world is in economic transformation and also in economic trouble at the moment. Even a very rich country like Austria, we are in deep recession, the biggest recession after World War II, and we see a certain decline also in other rich countries. Now, you have this extreme long experience in banking and development finance. Do you think that the concept of innovation, which we have to define a little bit, might be a way out of the crisis we are in?
Thank you, Andrea. And once more, thank you very much for having me on the program. The CV sounds very rich, but I hope I can do this conversation justice. Look, innovation is a word we all throw about quite frequently these days. And I think it is an all-encompassing, cross-cutting concept. So whether you're talking the use of enabling technology in finance, in socials, in health, hospitals, etc., or whether you're talking about creativity, just new solutions to old problems, new way of looking at things, new lenses. The word innovation, I think, is something that must remain with us as we transcend the current problems that you so well highlighted with regards to the global economic constraints that we have at the moment, which mean with regards to an organization like CARE, which both you and I belong to, we have to think very creatively about a world in which the former free, rich, wealthy contributions may be more constrained in the coming 5 to 10 years, maybe, because nationals also have their own countries to look after. And so I think we have to start thinking differently about how we solve existing problems, old problems. So innovation for me, whichever way you look at it, whether it's in social setting, economic setting, donor funding setting, and the use of technology are going to be inevitable for us to get on top of.
But listening to you, the concept of innovation contains mainly that we need new concepts and solutions for nearly everything, to put it bluntly, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
To achieve in the future, a better future for all of us.
I think that's correct. And I think we're very fortunate because we are living in an era where, with all of the constraints that we have, we are also living in an era where even our traditionally recipient audiences who would be out of touch, not connected, are actually more connected now through technology, cell phones, digital, etc. So it's actually, I think, I always say in the ashes rise the phoenix. So in this demise at the moment, we must look at what is the opportunity there. And for me, the real opportunity is connectivity, digital connectivity, global connectivity, and using that, which has actually created ambition and aspirations in, let's speak about Africa, because that's where I'm from, but for the underserved, digitization, global connectivity, technology has created aspirations and ambition that we would not have known before. So there's a meeting of the minds in terms of let us rise out of these situations of poverty and degradation.
I think that you created a very interesting picture, at least in my head. Let's help the phoenix rise all together, because we have enormous achievements ahead of us. And I also think it's an interesting time that we are living in. But still, let's talk a little bit more in detail. And now we turn to so-called sub-Saharan Africa. And I also want to highlight, because this is very often done in outer African contexts, that people talk about Africa as if it would be one large country. I mean, we are fully aware, that's very clear, because Dorica, you are from Zambia, correct?
Yes.
And Africa consists of 54 countries and states, and depending on the region, they are very different in their appearance and also in their economic and social power. And CARE is working in many of them. And let's start a bit about talking. You are the financial specialist. Financial market development is key for all countries in sub-Saharan Africa, I think we could say. And CARE has a special program, which are the saving and loan groups, which were invented in the 90s in West Africa, in Niger, if I remember correctly, by one of the CARE staffs. And this saving and loan groups is for people who really live in remote rural areas to spark or to enable them to become at least the first step for financial literacy, right? So is this helping over the 30 years that this was done and CARE USA and also other CARES, including CARE Austria, we are contributing to scaling this project to really many countries, and thousands or millions of women, mainly women, are participating in it. Is this helping building something like a financial market?
Yeah, I love this question, Andrea, because it allows me to dignify the women and the communities. It's not just women, but the communities that participate in these SLA, savings and loan schemes, if I can call them that. I start from the premise of what we did with the savings and loan schemes is to formalize something that was already happening. Formalize it, institutionalize it, introduce some rules around it, and also give it ambition. Why do I say that? Many African communities, many Asian communities, you find that let's talk about women, because this is something that is very special to CARE, and I want to be specific in this conversation. You find that the women always get together and contribute, and through that contribution, each one is allowed to then withdraw over time X amount. So it's a rotation kind of thing. You put it into a pot, and every other month or every 6 months, depending on how many you are able to draw down for that for your own expenditure. It can be CapEx. If you're running an ice cream shop, a little ice lolly shop, you want to buy a freezer, you want to buy a solar panel. This has worked. It's worked for years and years in the African context, certainly in the Zambia context. But I can't truly say in the African context. What we have done with SLA is to take what was already an existing solution. And this is what I love about CARE. You take something that is already existing and you try to amplify it and make it ubiquitous and available for all, but you also try to make it bankable. Whether we like it or we don't, you need the financial system to be able to allow continuous access to finance. So for me, the SLR systems have actually formalized what was already being done. What does that mean? That means that women can, the women who belong to these groups, can now start to think, I call it the virtuous cycle. It started with microfinance, access to finance, which was hand to mouth. And that hand to mouth allowed people to buy equipment to enable them to do whatever it is that they do to put food on the table and to pay school fees, etc. It is now moving into wealth creation and wealth preservation. Mm-hmm. Through the savings and loans, the savings part of it is critical because it is now teaching women to save for a rainy day, to save for an emergency. So you've moved from the traditional old microfinance, access to finance, hand to mouth, to a situation now where you're encouraging these women and these groups to think about savings, which build resilience. If there is a drought, if there is a flood, you have some way you can touch to be able to immediately recover. So I love it, and I think there's still work to be done, but many of these institutions, thanks to CARE, are becoming bankable institutions of community.
That would happen, and that, I think,
is the critical
next issue. Question. Because I also had, of course, the privilege to see many of those saving and loan groups. And it's really impressive that they also work in really super remote areas. If we think about the Sahel states, then you have lots of areas which are really remote and people don't have nearly nothing to live on a daily basis. And even there, it is working really well because it doesn't create dependence on any other banking or financial institution, which I think is the reason why CARE could really spread this approach in many, many countries, because we are not going there now to debate the pros and cons of microcredits, but we have learned over history that microcredits is not suitable for all places in the same way, and many states are very restrictive when it comes to microcredits, but are not when it comes to saving and loan, because there is no foreign money in the box. It's only the money of the people, and they have to do all the administration. And it has a lot of positive side effects, right? Because the women, they don't only need what they do traditionally, but they also learn a lot. Yes. And some of them are really, really successful. And you know it's better than I, or as much as I, that some of them are that much successful that over the years they created really quite high revenue. And the next step is that they could become bankable, like it is called, which is a strange expression, I think. But also in Austria, we see, I think we are the fifth or sixth richest country, according to OECD. But also in Austria, there are quite a lot of, especially women and people with migrant background, and some of them not highly educated, who are not bankable. And we have a bank in Austria who creates special approaches for those people to become bankable. So would you say that saving and loan groups were bridging the gap a little bit in some sub-Saharan African countries?
I would say so. I will mention Kenya. I will mention Zambia as well, my home country. I will mention Ghana, Tanzania. Andrea, you and I visited Tanzania together. Mm-hmm. You actually saw that these savings and loans groups are getting to a point where they are formalizing so much that they are doing two things. Number one, they are opening bank accounts as a group. First of all, they are registering. So they are having to be registered as a group, which already puts them into the formal system. Now, not everybody is going to have to be formal, but it does mean that you've got a group of informal, so-called informals, that are now stepping up ahead, so bridging the gap. So number one, they're registering. They know the rules. They put rules around them. Number two, they are opening bank accounts. So they are adding to the deposit bases of banks, but they are also creating a credit history for themselves as an organization, but also for the individuals that make up that organization. Number three, they are learning to borrow. So they are learning to leverage the asset, which today may be cash, that they have, to be able to borrow for purposes of acquiring new assets and building more. So that bridging of the gap, I think, is extremely important.
And isn't it also changing the position of these women in their own, let's say, village societies, because they really create some economic power, right? And they own it.
They create economic power. The answer to your question is absolutely yes. They create economic power for themselves, which is a dignity, pride, presence issue. They create ambition for themselves because, you know, all of us are human beings. Once you see 100 become 120, you want it to become 160, you want it to become 200. So it creates that ambition that they never before had. But also, it can do one of two things. Initially, it used to create imbalance in the home, and you get issues and problems of gender-based violence because the men feel disenfranchised, and why is this woman becoming so independent? But more and more, as the men appreciate that this is extra income in the home that allows them to do things that they were never before able to do, it is now changing to becoming a respect for women that our men never had for a longer time. I don't mean all of our men, but the majority of our men have not had for a long time.
I think
the multiplier effect is unquantified for the time being.
And I really am deeply convinced that this is not only applicable to the African context, because gender equality is also one of the top topics still in Europe. From the legal side, we have achieved a lot, but from a practical side, we see a sort of backlash. Yeah. And as CARE is focusing, of course, I'm so often asked, are you only helping women? No, we are not only helping women and girls. We help men, boys, everybody, but we have a strong focus on women and girls, which is really somehow a standalone criteria in international NGO arena. And talking about gender equality, I see, and I'm curious to hear your take on it. There are two pillars, more or less. So the one is the very pragmatic economic one, because also here, as a woman, when you are independent and really free to make your choices in life, you have to have a solid income. Financial dependence is somehow nothing that any woman in the world, no matter in which context, should intentionally go for. At least this was something that my mother told me right from year three or something, and including my father. Second, there is, of course, the human rights aspect. It's also a human right, gender equality. This is nothing that is invented by, that was invented by scientists and feminists. This is a basic human right. And to execute your rights, you have to have a certain level of education. Otherwise, it's very difficult to really make your point and get your right and live your rights. So I was so impressed, Dulika, when I heard you talking in Tanzania about, I don't quote you correctly, but the sense of it was, I have been walking through capitals of African states for decades, and not so much was changing. Second aspect, before I give the word to you, we visited in Tanzania, an interesting project, no doubt about that. We saw young girls that got a very quick training for tailoring clothes, and then they can have their own sewing machine and sell them in the market. And I was asking myself and also some of my colleagues, I have been in this sector for 30 years now, how many tailors does Africa need? Or a country like Tanzania. I don't know. How many tailors do we need? We talk a lot about financial literacy. We talk about digital literacy nowadays. We come to that. Can you elaborate a little bit on your thoughts and challenge us a bit? What is needed really today?
You know, this is such a long topic, Andrea. So let me try to focus a little bit. And I speak now to the audience that I know is the audience of this podcast. Every woman in Africa today is looking for independence, financial independence, social independence, domestic independence. They are ambitious, if not for themselves, then certainly for their children, male and female. Ambitious in terms of financial freedom, ambitious in terms of social freedom, ambitious in terms of their daughters being able to be in marriages, in relationships that respect them and hold them in high esteem. They have aspirations, they have dignity, they want honor. And so if we take that as the premise from which we are speaking about these women, if you want your daughter to achieve that dream, what is it that you give her? You give her a sense of confidence, self-confidence. You don't distinguish her in upbringing in the home between her brother. Number two, you give her education, a relevant education. Today we read in my country today, we have given free education for children. The question I ask is, you can have 1,000 children in a classroom, and I'm not saying there are, but there certainly are 100 in many classrooms, and they are in school, but are they learning relevant, quality, future-proofing kind of education? The answer is going to be no. And so as we think about education, we must think about, is it relevant not for today, but for 100 years, for 50 years from today? This is important not just for the girl child, but also for the boy child. Not just important for the child, important for who is going to be running our economies and our parliaments, if they will still exist, our governments, our hospitals in the future when I am no longer able to work. Right now, 66% of the generation below 25 in my 66% of the population in my country is below the age of 25. Of that, maybe 5 to 10% can afford to, will be able to run the world in which I want to live in. And so this question of education, relevant, appropriate education, is extremely important for us to leapfrog the problems social that we have today. And they're global problems. The whole issue of migration, illegal immigrants. By the way, illegal immigrants are a small component of total immigrants. A lot of immigrants go. The UK has just published their numbers today. 90% of the immigrants that come into this country are actually legal immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so the global implications of us not focusing on equipping women, particularly, we are 52% of the population globally today, it has some serious consequences. And so, as I said, this is a long subject matter. For me, if I say one point, if I put one thought in everybody's heads today, whoever's going to listen to this podcast, it is that we need good quality, useful, future useful education for our women, our girl children, and especially for our boys. But they need to be informed not just in terms of subject matters, mathematics, technology, sciences. They need to be informed in terms of civic rights. Civic rights, civic education, civic participation, active citizenry. Many of our citizens are not active in our countries. So the politicians, I'm sorry if there are politicians who will listen to this, but in many of our countries, the politicians are able to just ride over people because people are not clear about what their civic rights, their citizen ship requires in terms of activity. Many times our people tell you the government has to do something about something, but you have to pressure government to do something about something. Mm-hmm. So this whole piece of education is a very big, big discussion. And for me, spans all manner of isms, social, culture, commerce, and so on.
And you're absolutely right, Dolika. And unfortunately, I have to say, we can't become too political because you and I, we are fully aware that CARE is globally working with institutional funding. But, and these are also issues, and I think this is what brings us much closer together than in the last 20, 30 years, that the same issues on different levels are debated. because also here we have a certain fatigue in our own society. Believe it or not, there is a fatigue for democracy.
Mm.
Not everybody is convinced that democracy is something precious that we should stand and fight for, because it's taken as a given, as a thing that was always there, and that is, and people even don't want to recognize when it is endangered. Can you believe that, Tonika? Yeah. So it's a different, not a higher or lower level. It's a bit of different discussion, but it's framing a bit the same problem. Then, because we want to live in free, democratic, wealthy states, but we as citizens have to do a lot to do so. It's not happening by itself, right?
Exactly.
Neither in Europe nor in any African country.
Absolutely. Yeah? I couldn't agree with you more.
And after 30 years in this sector, I have to say that I see that the world becomes smaller because the problems become more and more globalized. It's not any longer this idea of the poor people sitting in any African country waiting for anything.
Yeah.
No, we are all in the same boat. The world is very small today. Mm-hmm. And through globalization, we can link as easy as never before.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, and digitalization. And this is why I fully want to agree and to highlight with you that we are living in very interesting times, and we should not shy away from the challenges ahead of us. We should embrace them somehow and make these tools useful and accessible to all of us. And this is something we have big debates also in CARE, because we do some educational programs, but people are always a bit unhappy with me when I say, is this what children learn in this school really think that they will need? Because we have a bit of romantic view, children sitting in any school, be it in South Asia or in any African country, and they are learning and they are getting literate, yes, but these are the basics.
Exactly.
Looking in highly developed Asian countries, even the education in Europe is lagging behind.
Yeah.
So let's face it, we are not the benchmark anymore. We have our own problems to solve. But digital literacy is so key also for financial literacy, isn't it?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that, look, it's a good problem to have, if I can express it that way, Andrea. It is a good problem to have. The conversation we are having now is not a conversation we would have been having 20, 25 years ago.
This conversation
is saying technology, globalization has made borders porous.
Yeah.
Technology knows no borders. So I can be sitting in Zambia and somebody sitting in Zambia is going to have the same access to this podcast as your, mm-hmm. your relative sitting in Austria.
Yeah.
So the ideas, the concepts, these are becoming global ideas. The comparisons are starting to happen. What is good? What does good look like? We just talked about education. We know that traditionally Europe was far ahead of many, many countries in terms of the quality of education. And here comes Asian countries, and they have upended that theory.
Mm-hmm.
So the world is indeed, as you rightly said, it's not just a small place. In my view, it is one place.
Mm.
It is one place. And so we need to think about the implications of what we do. It is no longer them and us.
Yeah.
It is all of us.
Yeah.
So whatever we do, every day I wake up, I say to myself, I am not safe until everybody around me is safe. Until there will always be inequalities. I always tell people there will always be inequalities, but the gap of the inequality that we are experiencing today is not sustainable.
No.
We will not build enough castles to hide behind.
Mm-hmm.
We live in an apartment on Avenue X. We have two cars. Our children go to private school. There will not be enough castles built to protect mm-hmm. us from that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so we have to be proactive mm-hmm. about expanding the accessibility to basic, good quality services that allow people to be productive in their own space. Most people want a house, a home. a roof over their house, food on the table, education for their children, and a health system that they can go to should something go wrong.
So access to normal commodities.
That's normal
that commodity. everybody needs and has. And I love your way to put things when you say we couldn't build enough castles. Mm. And we should also make sure that as many people as possible around us in a global context are safe, because it's also for our own benefit. And I think this is what our political leaders in the North and the so-called South should be more aware of and should more communicate about. Yeah, because in the end, I'm not proud any longer of our human rights and things like that. Yes, they are there. They are written on paper. Some people still keep them high. But looking at what is happening at the European borders or at the border in the channel between the UK and Europe is nothing that we can be proud of, that people are drowning, losing their lives, risking their lives. And that so many are killed just for trying
in search of a better life. And it becomes more complex, Andrea. I don't want to take time away because I know we have limited time. It becomes more complex when you put on the fact that you raised at the very beginning that even in the developed world, that terminology is now under a lot of scrutiny, but for the sake of the conversation, even in so-called developed markets today, there is a lot of struggle.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of struggle for the right education, for the right health systems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything for the
economy. Isn't that an interesting phenomenon in that conversation that two women of similar age from completely different cultural backgrounds are agreeing that we have the same problems to solve, no matter where you were born, where you come from, and what your plan in life was maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah. And what that means for me is that it behooves the global world, those of us privileged enough to be at this conversation, to say, so what is the root cause and how do we participate in addressing the root cause? The root cause in many of our countries, quite frankly, is an issue of governance. Politely put, corruption, if I'm going to be rude. So how do we deal with those root causes that divert available funding from where it should go, education, hospitals, food, nutrition, resilience, etc.? How do we help to deal with that root cause? And we can, even at the care level. You were not in Ghana with us. In Ghana, we went to a village outside Kumasi, which is quite a distance from the capital, Accra. And in this village was the most amazing project that I have seen CARE do in my 3 years on the board. And it was a demonstration, a mock-up of a parliament. And this parliament was all staffed by young ladies between the ages of 8 and 12, if I recall, and they were debating the issues of gender-based violence. There was a speaker, there was an opposition leader, there was a social minister. It was a remake of the parliament of Ghana. And they debated. And the intelligence and the aspirations and the challenges that came through that civic education class, I said, wow, why can't we put this in every school across the continent of Africa and maybe beyond?
And where do you see the role of CARE in all of that we debated? Is there, from your point of view, looking into the next 5 years, because I think this is already a long time to predict it, I think we have a crucial role to play, but not we as sitting in the so-called North and you sitting sometimes in the North and in the South like me, but we are part of the privileged crowd. But I think we need totally new concepts to overcome all of these categories.
Mm. Mm.
And what is the role of CARE to play in that?
So from my perspective, let us start at what is it that I want us to achieve as a society globally. And that for me is to create societies, nations, countries, continents where people feel they have an opportunity. The people from that country feel they have an opportunity to upward mobility through the basics of education. We need a healthy, a stunted nation. I think it's a Adesina of the AFDB, Africa Development Bank, who always says, a stunted nation is a stunted economy. So we need to make sure our children are not stunted physically for lack of food and nutrition, and they are not stunted intellectually for lack of education. With those two things, we need to create a facilitating environment where those who are able can move through the channels and upwardly move. That's why people educate their children, so that their children can live a better life than they can. And that is not happening. And CARE, I think, has a crucial role to play in those areas that start to demonstrate CARE is not big enough to solve the world's problems on its own. But it has a crucial role in demonstrating what can work and what can be achieved. So that what I described in Ghana, for example, the mock parliament by girls, that is a demonstration project. And at a bilateral level, maybe our people can be talking to each other and saying, well, this is working here. Why can't you replicate it under your education strategy? So that's number one, very crucial for CARE to be doing demonstrative projects that can work. And in education, in health, which we are doing, and in the ability to have access to finance, not day-to-day. So move away from this lens of donations. We have to survive on donations as an institution, but move away from us giving money to people to deal with the daily basics. Teach a man, the old adage of teach a man to fish. So I think CARE has a crucial role to play here. And I think we're getting there because we're pivoting, or we have pivoted from the traditional way of working with communities to actually the aspirational. It used to be a survival. I think we are moving people to aspirational. So we are doing, we've moved now to helping financial structures, what you just talked about, the savings and groups. We've moved to civic education, what we just talked about in Ghana. And I think more of that kind of thinking. But fundamentally, relying on the society's own ways of living. You cannot force people to do something alien. You have to leverage what they... These people have solutions already on the ground. They know what needs to be done. They just do not have the tools, the means, the guidance to leverage it, to scale up. And I think CARE has a massive role to play there. And I think we're there. That's why we go with locally grown and then globally supported, because we know that the solution has got to come from the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we can harvest a lot from the richness of knowledge in any place that CARE gets access to work, because I'm putting it that way because I'm very much aware of the fact that no matter what we are doing, we are always a guest in a given country. And we build a way of collaborating for a better way for many people. But it's nothing that is sparked outside the country where the project is implemented. The funding comes from outside the country, as you put it so nicely. Let people do like they want to do it if they would have the financial means. Brokers, like global brokers for knowledge and also for financial streams. But I see that our role has already changed because we discuss so often about the new role that we need to have. But I think it has already changed, and it changes no matter what we decide, because the world is changing.
I think if you look at the board of CARE, certainly CARE USA, as I joined it, but we are one group. If you look at the board of CARE USA, as an African woman, a Black African woman, to be sitting on that board, I think if we look at the board maybe 15 years ago, it would have looked very differently. I could be wrong, but it would have looked very differently. And I'm not the only one. So that movement in and of itself, I think, is a very big signal. I also think care, and this is my last point on this one, I do think care has a role, a challenge, myself included, to start in Africa looking at who are possible African philanthropists. Mm-hmm. We have a wealth now of wealthy Africans. We have to tap into them and challenge them to be part of the care solution. They have to join that donor group of funders. I won't name them, but there are enough that as a project, I think care, we must bring in homegrown people and wealthy into the care donor spectrum. We will also get their perspective on things.
Mm-hmm, of course. And this closes the cycle of our conversation. And I mentioned that I tend more and more to look at what care is doing is really brokering. And I think it is key that philanthropists from not only from the African context, but we focus today on that, but also from the Asian context, Middle East, wherever you name it, joins this philanthropic movement and not only bring funding to the table, but also their views, their ideas, and their precious knowledge. And I think change is something very good, and we should not shy away as an organization from massive change that we have to undergo and we are already undergoing. So let's end with a positive view on the future. If you have one professional wish in your function as a board member of CareUS, what would that be, Dolika?
One. I think we've spoken about some of the nuggets that mm-hmm. I think I should focus on. I think from my perspective is to just, you know, everything I do, every thought I have, every step I make, when I wake up in the morning, I think to myself, I'm able-bodied, I'm sighted, and I'm able to speak. So mine is about obliterating the term below the poverty line. We should not be talking about this. Mm-hmm. And talking about 90% of the, so today, 6.5 billion people, I picked this up from a World Bank report, that's 44% of the global population is living on $6.85, $6.85 per day. 44%. But take away the percent, that's 6.5 billion people. I find that very hard to believe because I thought that was how many we are in the 3.5 billion. I'm so sorry. 3.5 billion out of 6 billion, roughly. That's still a lot of heads. I don't think of it in terms of percentages. It's a lot of people walking around, but lying on streets. It's cold in London now. I walk from the office to my hotel. There are street people lying around the tube station. This has got to stop. So care for me is to move that dialogue so that we're not talking about people below the poverty line anymore. We're talking about how people have gotten above the poverty line. So let us bring those positive stories. The Africa today is not all that we see on television all the time. The Africa today has entrepreneurs. It has female business owners. It has female politicians in place. It has young, Botswana has just finished their elections. It seems to be the youngest parliament in the whole of Africa today. Those stories, I think care must be a part of telling so that we motivate. Motivation slides so easily off the tongue, but it is hard. We have access. Let us give the stories that motivate for a better world, a higher world, a more fun world with all of its problems. But let us tell that story about Africa as well. That would be my ask of care going forward.
And I do really hope that our conversation motivated and is going to motivate many people that are listening to us to join CARE and to support the global work of CARE. Dolika Banda, you were a fabulous guest of our podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you so much, Andrea. And I want to reemphasize that I was talking about 3.5 billion people because the 6.8 is the total population. But I have enjoyed this. I look forward to seeing you again. And all I would say is may we continue, may we not give up, may we just continue to be motivated to be a part of the solution. Because if you're not a part of the solution, then we're definitely a part of the problem.
Thanks for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast of Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For further information, go to care.at. Sponsored by CC Real.